Chapter 15. Field Maneuvers. Before being shipped to the South Pacific, we had to take part in a 2-day training exercise on the Big Island of Hawaii. Half of the Big Island is rainforest, and the other half is desert, so you could experience all kinds of terrain. Our maneuvers took place out in the desert, which looked very much like our own Denetka. It even had some of the same plants. Like many of the things that happened to me during the war, that training exercise made me very glad that I was a Navajo. We had a gung-ho lieutenant. Everybody called him Stormy. "We're going to see how tough you guys are," he said. "We're going to cross this desert on foot in 2 days. You've got just one canteen of water each, so you have to make it last. There's no other way you can get water out here." When he said that, Key, Bill, and Henry and I, the four of us who were Navajos, looked at each other and nodded. We had all seen the clumps of prickly pear cactuses that were growing everywhere. We started out, and it was hot. Pretty soon, the other Marines, including the lieutenant, were drinking from their canteens. But not us Navajos. Whenever Stormy wasn't watching, we would cut off a piece of prickly pear cactus, scrape off the spines, and suck out the juice. We knew there was a lot of water inside a prickly pear, even if Stormy didn't have a clue. By night, just about everyone else's canteens were almost empty. The next day was even hotter. We went about another 10 miles, and people just wore out. "Have you guys still got water?" another Marine asked me. I held up my canteen and shook it, so he could hear all the water sloshing around. "How the heck can he get along without water?" "Oh," I said, "I'm just not thirsty." "That's just the Indian way," Key added. By about 2 o'clock that afternoon, everybody but us Navajos had collapsed. Stormy was sitting on a little hill. "Come on," Henry said to him. "We got 10 more miles to go." "You fellas still got water?" he asked in a cracked voice. "Sure," I said, offering my canteen. "Here, Lieutenant, you can have some of mine." He raised one hand weakly. "No," he said, "that wouldn't be fair." Then he stood up and looked back at his worn-out Marines. "If any of you can't make it, just wait here. I'll have them send back water from camp." He got about 100 yards before he fell down. Everybody else fell down right behind him, except us. We four were the only ones standing. Bill tried to help him get up, but he just waved us away. "Chiefs," Stormy croaked up at us, "do you suppose you guys could go all the way into camp? I'm going to write a letter for you to take to Colonel Wood, asking him to send us out some water." We did like he said. By the time the water truck got out to them, they were all about dead. We never did tell Stormy about prickly pear cactuses. It was more fun having him and the others think that we Navajos were the toughest Marines of all. A few days after that, we shipped out. I was with the 3rd Division, 9th Regiment, along with several other code talkers, including Bill Toledo. Just as the scuttlebutt had it, we men of the 1st Marine Amphibious Corps were headed for the Solomons to force a landing on Bougainville. We had to drive out the Japanese and secure the airfields. We didn't go straight into battle, though. First, we had more field maneuvers. This practice was really important. It was to make sure that things didn't go wrong too much. I say too much, grandchildren, because one of the unwritten rules of war is to expect the unexpected. If there's any possible way that something can go wrong, you can bet the ranch that it will. Imagine 2 dozen ships and 12 different landing beach sites. Think about all the preliminary airstrikes and naval bombardment before even boarding the landing crafts. Those LCVPs, short for landing crafts for vehicles and personnel, and LCMs, short for landing crafts, mechanized, that we all just called alligators. There were also the LSTs, much bigger landing ships that carried tanks and trucks. Then picture 14,000 Marines and 6,000 tons of cargo hitting the beaches by nightfall. Plus, We had to do this against an unknown enemy force dug in and waiting for us with rifles, machine guns, mortars, and artillery. There was no way to avoid foul-ups. However, practicing a beach landing in a similar setting would help prepare everyone better than just going into a situation cold. So where do we go to practice? Guadalcanal. From October 17 to 19 of 1943, we conducted landing exercises on the beaches of the canal. Every Marine who'd be landing on Bougainville felt what it was like to wade through the surf up onto a boiling hot sandy beach and then stare into the thick mysterious green of a steamy tropical jungle. Wet and hot. That's what it was everywhere in the Solomons. If I hadn't already been on Hawaii, which had some jungle of its own, it would have been a total shock to me. Think how strange it was for a Navajo boy from a land where rain is so rare that it's a blessing from the holy people, to find himself in a place where it rains every day and sometimes keeps on raining for days on end. Instead of the night songs of the coyote, we would hear the buzzing and chirping and chattering of millions of insects, all of which seemed to see us Marines as their midnight snacks. But they would give us something in return for their meal. Malaria. I had to be careful where I walked and sat. There were leeches and spiders and scorpions everywhere, as well as huge poisonous centipedes. The first one I saw fell from a branch and crawled across my bare arm before flopping off and disappearing into the rotten palm leaves. It left an angry red welt on my skin, and my whole arm ached for days after that. There were also giant crocodiles in the swamps and rivers, man-eating sharks and poisonous jellyfish in the ocean. And I didn't even want to think about the snakes in that jungle. There were native people on those islands. They had been there long before the Japanese invaded. Those Solomon Islanders were short, about the same height as us Navajos. Their skins were dark black, almost blue. Their hair was curly and red, because they dyed it with lime juice. Their teeth were stained red, too, because they were always chewing betel nuts. That dangerous, steamy island was their beloved home. They saw it the way we saw our dry land of Dnetka. It was a sacred place given to them by their gods, and they knew how to survive and be happy there. But they hadn't been happy during the Japanese occupation. Although the Japanese said they were liberating the island, they used the native people like slaves, beating or killing them if they tried to escape. It was a familiar story to me as a Navajo. It made me feel I had much in common with them. So I spoke more often to the islanders than most white Marines did. Those natives talked a kind of broken English called Pidgin, which was not too hard to understand. I remember one man named Jean Jean, who was a sort of chief. He had terrible scars all over his chest from when the Japanese had tied him to a tree and tortured him by stabbing him with their bayonets. They'd wanted him to tell them where the American soldiers were, but he'd refused to talk. When night fell, he got loose and crawled to the water. Then, in spite of being weak from the loss of blood, he swam for 3 miles through water filled with sharks and crocodiles to reach an American ranger squad and tell them where the Japanese were. One day, Jean Jean approached me. "You come," he said. He took me by the arm and led me to a big rock near the ocean. We sat together there for a time without saying anything. Then he bent over, pressed his palm on the ground, and lifted his hand up to rest it against his chest. I understood. He was telling me this land was in his heart. I knelt down on one knee and did the same, then swung my hand in the direction of the rising sun. Jean Jean nodded. He understood that the land of my own heart was there, far across the wide ocean. He placed his left hand on my chest, and I did the same. We stood there like that for a while, feeling each other's hearts beat with love for our sacred homelands. It was one of the best conversations I ever had. For our landing exercise at Guadalcanal, There was a full-scale debarkation of all the equipment and supplies we'd be taking with us when we did it all for real. Bill Toledo and I climbed into a blunt-nosed, 36-foot-long Higgins boat with 30 other men, and were lowered over the side into the calm sea half a mile offshore. Then we chugged in at 6 knots an hour toward the tranquil beach. "Okay," our officers yelled. "Go, go, go." My combat pack was on my back, my rifle held at the ready. I jumped in, feeling the warm water fill my boots. It was strange knowing that American blood had darkened the surf of this island I was landing on so easily. Then my feet sank into the sand. For the first time, I was on soil where American Marines had died fighting the Japanese. I slogged bow-legged up from the beach as quickly as I could through the deep black volcanic sand. I was carrying an 80-pound TBX radio set strapped to my chest, so I wasn't able to run really fast. Bill waited for me at the edge of the jungle. I crouched next to him and looked back at the beach. Hundreds of Marines were calmly climbing out of the alligators. Some looked serious, but there was a lot of laughing and joking. Trucks and tanks roared down the ramps of LSTs. Planes buzzed low overhead. There were all the sounds of a full-scale training maneuver. Everything was running like clockwork. 50 yards farther down the beach, George, another code talker and our most experienced radio man, waved at us. Bill and I waved back. Bill shook his head. "You know what's missing?" he said. I nodded back at him. What was missing was chaos. There was none of the noise and confusion of real battle. No enemy fire. No bullets striking us. No mortar shells exploding. No wounded men screaming in pain or calling for their mothers. Instead, at one moment when everything was quiet, I heard the haunting cry of a bird echo out from somewhere deep inside the jungle. Our only attackers were a swarm of mosquitoes that descended on me, humming their thirst for my blood.